What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Steve Garber. So Steve is the professor of marketplace theology and the director of the program in leadership, theology, and society at Regent College in Vancouver, BC, which sounds awesome. Like, those are some great titles. But Steve is just like the most down-to-earth guy that I've talked to in like a long time. He's the sort of just this calming presence, and you feel that in this interview. Steve has been thinking about and working on this theology of vocation for such a long time, and this interview is so just packed full of just amazing insight into this topic. This is the interview where we really just like, we delve into the intangible parts of this whole discussion, and we just talk in depth about what this means, but like practically, not on like a really heady way, but just in real practical terms. And so I think you're going to love this episode. The reason I got him is because he has this book called The Seamless Life, and it's about all these things where there's no, you know, seams, there's no different parts of you, I guess. You could say. And so this book, though, is written in a very different format. It's sort of like shorter essays all brought together. And just like, I thought I would sort of tear through it like it's sort of a small book. And it took me so long to get through this book because each essay just sort of needed to be digested and just like worked through. And so I highly encourage you to pick it up. It's one that you can kind of, you can read, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes and just have like a lot of processing time off of that. He also has a couple of other books. One's called Visions of Vocation. And I just encourage you to check all of those books out, especially on this topic. I mean, Steve has done some serious work, some serious processing, some serious contemplation. He's talked to a lot of people about this topic. So I just encourage you to check his stuff out. If you want to make sure and stay up to date with Theology of Hustle, make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford. You can keep up with the happenings with the podcast. And I hope you're staying safe out there. I hope you enjoy. Maybe share this episode with some of your friends just so they can, you know, check out Theology of Hustle, especially right now. We have a little extra time on our hands with the pandemic and all. So feel free to share away and maybe encourage somebody else in their vocation, thinking through their vocation, even in a time like this. I think it's a good time to be thinking through some of that stuff. And so I hope you enjoy this episode with Steve. All right. Well, Steve, I can't say thanks enough for making some time for me to come on the podcast and chat a little bit.
It's a good gift to be with you, Curry. Thank you.
I love it. Let's just jump off here to start off and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody.
So my name is Stephen Garber, and I'm married to Meg, who's a good woman. And she still loves me, and that's the great gift of my life. We have 5 adult children and about 10 grandchildren, and they're scattered across the U.S. I was born in Colorado, in the mountains of Colorado, and grew up in California, and thought that the West was the world for the first 20 years of my life. I didn't really want any other world. I didn't imagine any other world. Mm. All the movies and TV of my growing up years were set in Southern California and looked normal to me. Then I first had my experience going to the East and thinking, I don't like humidity at all, really. I don't like to be cold like that either, you know, in that kind of way. But we lived in Virginia for 30 years, and I've been teaching for my whole life in different kinds of capacities. Along the way, I got involved with the Lilly Endowment. After many years working for the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, first as a professor and then as scholar in residence. So in some ways, getting involved with, I know you're a Wheaton grad, and getting involved with Wheaton, speaking to the faculty there several times and students, and going all the way across the country from Gordon College to Biola and Westmont and Point Loma Nazarene and Wheaton and Calvin and Covenant and Geneva and all the schools in between, actually. Did that for a long time. In many ways, I had this sort of deeper sense of calling to give myself to rethinking how learning ought to be seen in the world. The Lilly Endowment drew me into a wonderful project, a very generous grant they created called the Programs in the Theological Exploration of Vocation. And in some ways, that was a turning point in my own life. They said, we see your name on how this money is being used. They gave $2 million grants to 90 schools across the country, all with ecclesial histories. So Baylor, the Good Baptist School, got $2 million, and so did Calvin, the Good Reformed School, got $2 million, and Notre Dame, the Catholic School, got $2 million, and Davidson and Duke and Wake Forest, and 90 schools all across the country got wow. within Wesleyan, Calvinist, Anabaptist, Catholic traditions. What does vocation mean then in the light of your own tradition? I asked, you know, them why I should get involved. They said, well, we see your name on how the money's being used. And I began to, in some ways, become more self-conscious of what I had been doing, I suppose. And they said, we think about you as a public teacher with as somebody who has a classroom across the country. And I began kind of thinking, is that what I've been doing then the last several years of my life? And, you know, I began to write about these things, and people began to come back to me with what they were reading, what I had been writing about it. And I would say if there's a deeper, longer sense of vocation in the work I've done, Curry, it has been the concern to understand what is it that is required to sustain a sense of vocation over the course of a lifetime.
Yeah,
my PhD work was about that many years ago, and then things I've written in the years since then have all been, in some ways, sort of as Aslan once, you know, said so wisely to the Pevensey children in Narnia, it's further up and further in. And so I think in many ways my life has been a further up and further in to that question for a long time. The Visions of Vocation book, you know, which against the Judah Wheaton kind of a guy, and it was chosen by Wheaton as a book to be read by all the students a few years ago. And
I didn't realize that. That's cool. I love that.
But the question of the book was, can you know the world and still love the world? And what I had come to think about it was that people who actually keep on keeping on are always people who, in some ways, grow up enough in the world to see that through the eyes of their hearts that it's a messy, broken, wounded world. You know, and living long enough in it, you get wounded yourself, actually.
Yeah.
And then what are you going to do with that? You know, and my argument in the book was that historically, going back literally thousands of years, human beings have decided either to be cynics on the one hand or stoics on the other hand. And both are ways to, and they're different kind of ways to suppress what you know to be true in Romans 1 language. Because you don't want to have to deal with the meaning of what you know, the weight of what you know. But if we are to imitate Christ in our own vocations, we have to figure out to be a way to be like God himself. How do you know the world and still love the world? Whether it's in the world of politics or the arts or education or economics and business or and on and on and on. How do you actually know what's going on in the world honestly and still choose to enter in with the vocation God has given you? So those are the things I think about all the time, really all the time, actually. And for the last few years, I've been teaching at Regent College in Vancouver, BC, professor of marketplace theology. And I also direct a master's program in leadership theology and society. So,
yeah. So you do a couple things. You have a few things going on. Okay. So I don't even know where to start, because you even in that you said so many good things. Let's start here. In your book, I found it very interesting. The Seamless Life, which we'll talk about sort of throughout this interview. You talk about, or you have a firm distinction between vocation and occupation that you come back to over and over again. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Just given who I am, and of course it's distinct and unique to me, I suppose, but in some ways I think it's a pretty human question for all of us everywhere. You know, whether they're 23-year-olds or 48-year-olds or even older than that, people come to me day after day, in some ways wrestling with the question, what am I going to do with my life? And I would say that over time, I've, you know, began thinking through the relationship of the words vocation, occupation, but then they're deep differences too. They sound a lot alike in some ways, and they overlap each other, I would say, but they're different words. Vocation to me is the longer, deeper story of my life and your life, everyone's life. It's who I am that makes me distinct in the world and unique in the world. It's who I am and why I am, and it's what makes me different than my brothers and my best friends and my wife, and that we can be close to each other by blood or by, you know, heart. You know, we are different people, really, and we're distinct people. Things that were true of me when I was 4 were truer when I was 10, and were even truer when I was 16, and became true in a different way when I got to be 30. And that's the story of me, really. Hmm. And that wasn't true of my big brother and my little brothers, and isn't true of my sons and my daughters and my wife either, really. Occupation is a word in my mind which actually is best understood by seeing it in relation to the word occupy. So that over the course of life, we occupy different relationships and responsibilities, which can change. And most of us do change. We're no longer living in medieval Europe or medieval anywhere, actually, where in some ways you were, you know, the son of or the daughter of, and at age 14, 15, you were already in what you were going to be about the rest of your life, really. We don't imagine the world that way anymore, actually. And so for most of us, we imagine, well, I'll be in grammar school and then high school and, you know, then college or not, and, you know, and then beyond college and the rest of my life. And then it may be in the next 2 or 3, you know, 10 years, I change 2 or 3 different times doing where I live and what I'm doing. And hopefully by you get to be more in the 30 something years, you begin to settle in and sort out and clarify. And, you know, maybe you're going to be doing that for the next years of your life, really. But you're occupying, in some ways, a different set of relationships and responsibilities that grow out of the deepening, clarifying sense of vocation. So the challenge and the hope we have, I think, is for continuity in our lives, so that over time, the vocation deepens. There's a sense of, this is me, actually. This is who I am, actually. Realizing in a now but not yet world, none of us ever have a complete overlap between vocation and occupation, because there's always a dissonance, there's always a tension. And so for me, when I'm sitting at a Starbucks of the world with a napkin in front of me, you know, I'm drawing 2 circles, actually, one with a V in it, one with an O in it, and I'm overlapping them, but then I scribble between them and say, but you see, there's always some tension for everybody. Sometimes by grace, there's less tension, but everybody has some conflict, has some sense of, you know, dissonance, I would say. And so for me, talking to people, I'm always trying to reassure them that you're not alone in the tension you feel.
Yeah, I think that's a profound thought. And I mean, it makes me feel better about my life, honestly. You know, it's like, I mean, all that sort of really makes sense. So then I didn't notice it in this book particularly, but then do you distinguish, or what would you say about the word calling then on top of all of that?
Great, good question, Curry. And you know, we could have a longer discussion about it someday, but literally the word vocation and calling are the same words. Mm-hmm. One is a Greek word, one is a Latin word. So they're really the very same words. And it's helpful, like most good words, to ask about the etymology. Where did this word come from? You know, so for us to think about, you know, the word vocation, we realize that it's related to the word vox, which is related to the word voice.
Right.
So the assumption, metaphysically, you know, in terms of the deepest beliefs we have about the universe, is that there's somebody speaking, you know, and that we actually have the ability to respond, to hear that voice that's being, you know, speaking out to us in the world. Hmm. So vocation is born out of vox, a voice. Calling, of course, even if you think about it, just like the word calling assumes a caller. So in some ways, for, you know, the modern secularists to use the word calling, in some ways they're borrowing from a world they don't really believe in.
Right.
Which in some ways has its own, you know, heartaches, I suppose, because in some way you want, like everyone, to have some sense of meaning and purpose to your life. One of my teachers has been Václav Havel, the Czech politician and playwright, and he said quite soberly, you know, in the years he was writing about these things, in the modern world, when we lose God, we lose access to meaning and purpose and accountability and responsibility. Mm-hmm. And you can see if you take those words together, it really is what we might assume and want a vocation or a calling to be all about. Meaning, purpose, accountability, responsibility. But Havel says, not as a Christian, really, but as, I would say, a more honest human being, saying, when we say this, we argue for this, you see, we have to give up talking about meaning, purpose, accountability, responsibility. So that's a stark line in the sand, I would say.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Speaking of Havel, I had never heard of him until I read about him in the book. Can you explain, because you talk about yourself being a student of his and, you know, for a long period of time. And what's that? Yeah. Can you explain about him a little bit?
Sure, I can. I've always been drawn, Curry, to people who don't confess, you know, faith, the gospel to be their own, the heart of their own commitments, but who I would say see more honestly, maybe more perceptively, and are willing to talk about it openly. It's easy in some ways, which we shouldn't stop doing, to quote a Wheaton College professor who believes that God is God, and you know that's true too and important too. Of course it is, really. You know, it's important that the editor of IVP actually believes God is there in the world. I mean, I'm just using Chicago here as a little reference point for everybody. But, you know, it's different, of course, when you think about somebody like Havel, who was celebrated globally for his political vision, but didn't do so, you know, because he was a notable Christian or because he even saw himself as a Christian. But he grew up in Czechoslovakia, which was, you know, born out of heartache and political terror throughout the 20th century. Mm-hmm. In 1938, basically the West gave Czechoslovakia to Hitler in a terrible, terrible, terrible move, where Chamberlain flew back to England with these, you know, empty, you know, hollow words, peace in our time. But a year later, of course, Hitler had said, nah, 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 you know, with horror in his heart, and said, I'm taking the world, actually. And he began to try to do that. We called it World War II. But Czechoslovakia was really the innocent lamb, you know, given away by the West. And Havel was born into that world. And people like Kafka, you know, a writer, you know, known for kind of hard to read books because they're just sort of fanciful and farcical and like absurd was the word, the absurdist literature. Mm. And people like Havel grew up into that world and were trying to make sense of what it could mean to be a human being in that world. I could tell a lot more about him, but you know, in the 1960s, he was beginning to write plays, pushing back against the totalitarian weight of communism, having come in and basically said, "We're going to rewrite your textbooks." Literally, you know, what you've thought about yourself no longer will be. We're going to rewrite the textbooks for Czechoslovakian children, For a moment in the sun, there was called the Prague Spring in 68, but then the tanks came in and, you know, it all became burdensome and wearisome all over again. And Havel's plays began to push back against that in the 70s, and finally he was banned from Prague and put into prison eventually in the 80s. And I'm just summarizing history very quickly here, but 89, when the communist dream began to implode globally, Havel was one of the leading voices in Czechoslovakia and was literally taken from prison and in a month became the president of this newly emerging Czechoslovakia and began giving speeches all over the world, Curry, which are astounding and amazing. Huh. I was in the U.S. Capitol, you know, in September, just walking through one evening and I saw, you know, everywhere in every little corner, there's a U.S. politician of some sort being remembered. And then in one surprising corner in a very visible place is a bust of Havel. Almost, you know, inexplicable, because why all the people in the world would we choose to have in the U.S. Capitol building Václav Havel in a designated place of honor, you know, in our Capitol? Mm-hmm. Except he began to give speeches all over the world and the U.S. Capitol, essentially asking this question: what are the political conditions, what are the conditions required for human beings to be able to act responsibly in history? And I walked through the streets of Prague on different occasions and just wanting to look at the balconies he spoke from and, you know, having a sense to breathe the air he breathed. And I've been to Czechoslovakia several times to speak and was there again in the fall. And the question, interestingly, this past fall from now Slovakian and Czech people, because they've broken apart as a country. But the question was, you've been listening to us very carefully over the years. You watched us when you've been here before, you've talked as if you actually know our poets and playwrights and taken our history seriously. Come back. This was an invitation last spring, but come back in the fall, because it'll be the 30th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution, as they called it. Velvet meaning there were no tanks and machine guns this time. Communism really just, you know, gasped and then, you know, died. But 30 years later, our question is, what does vocation mean for the common good of our part of the world?
Right.
So I spent a few days this past fall with them again, and being taken in one more time by their history and by their own hopes, and wanting to say something meaningful to them, and loving them more deeply and identifying with them in a strange way, in a way which has come to be a deeper part of my life. And so that's a little bit about Havel.
That's fascinating. Again, there's all these things that, you know, in history and this amazing people that you just like don't really know are out there, you know. So it's cool. That's awesome. Okay. So when you introduced yourself and you were talking about our interaction with the world, as I've like done this podcast, as I've talked to people, as I've learned more, I've realized that for a lot of Christians, there's a disconnect between the way that they, most of us, interact with the world and then like the reality of what's there. In that, I mean that there's this sense from a lot of Christians that sort of it's all going to burn, that the world is just evil in a lot of ways. And it colors our view of vocation as being sort of like just trying to get to the end times or whatever, right? Just trying to get to the end. But you would you push back on that sort of vision of what the world is all about?
Well, of course I would, Corey. But in some ways, I would never say it's a cheap thing to do so, because I would say all of us, in many ways, we stake our lives on a certain set of beliefs about the way the world is. Mm-hmm. I was teaching class last night and was underscoring that in both the book of Isaiah and the letter to the Corinthians, we have the writers of those days listening to their own cultural moments and quoting for eternity almost, at least quoting for the ages. Why not then just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? Right. It's interesting to hear the biblical, you know, writers quoting these words from their own moment in history. And you realize, as I would say it, Corey, that, you know, in Havel's terms or Nietzsche's terms before him, if God is gone, let's stop talking about meaning and morality. That was Nietzsche's, you know, conclusion. So here's, you know, somehow, and you know, thousands of years ago, when Isaiah was listening to his own moment and speaking prophetically into it, he's quoting for us, you know, thousands of years later, why not then just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Right.
And having Paul, you know, writing to the church in Corinth and saying the same thing, actually. Then I showed a little bit of Trippin' Billy's by Dave Matthews Band.
I love it.
He has exactly the same words, you know. If this is true about the world, then why not then just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? And I was playing out last night in class the relation of the ideas of meta-narrative and narrative. And particularly, I was sort of looking in at through these films by Terrence Malick, the American filmmaker who's, in some ways, his films never make it to the long runs at the cineplexes of the world because they require too much of us, I would say, probably.
Sure.
We are amusing ourselves to death in heart-aching ways in America and the world, and his films just ask too much of us to be long runs at the local cineplex. But most recently, the film A Hidden Life is a story about one man in the Austrian Alps in World War II years, and Nazism's creeping in to dominate Europe and Austria, and he basically says, how could I ever Heil Hitler? I cannot do that. I don't believe that. His neighbors, his lawyer, his priests all say to him, come on, you know, nobody will ever know. All you have to do is just say the words. Really, he says, I cannot do that. And the whole drama of the story is hinged on what he believes and what meaning has for his life. It's a 3-hour story. And actually, Malick, you know, allows this Austrian farmer's own deeply held Christian convictions to be the heart of his protest, fascinatingly. 7 years ago, Malick produced a film called The Tree of Life. And again, it's, you know, it's a story most of us probably wouldn't give the time to because it isn't very fun, or, you know, it's not about things that, excuse me, that we can even imagine, but it's really a story of the history of the universe. It's a meta-narrative about the nature of the cosmos. And in Augustinian terms, it is the story of creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. Now, Malick never names those as that. He never gives any sort of guidelines or footnotes to say, well, here's creation and here's fall and here's redemption, here's consummation. But that's a story he tells over the course of 3 hours. So what I was looking at last night was this relation between meta-narrative and narrative, and how whether we're Hindus or Muslims or evolution materialists or Christians, whatever we believe to be most true about the nature of the world, it shapes in some ways how we live in the world.
Right.
And of course, it's obviously true on the other side as well. How we live in the world shapes the way we see the world. So they play back and forth on each other. So for me, this question of, you know, can we just say, well, the world is, you know, going to hell in a handbasket and, you know, hold on. I just don't see it that way. I could say 1,000 things here, Kirby, but maybe I would simply, you know, offer you the words of another teacher beyond Howell, but this is John Stott, you know, who said in my hearing and hearing of many people all over the world, you know, years ago, why would you blame the world for being the world? Why wouldn't you ask, why weren't you the salt of the earth? Why weren't you the light of the world? He said, why would you walk into a dark room and curse the room for being dark? Why would you curse rotting meat for rotting? Why wouldn't you ask, so why wasn't this, the light turned on here? Why wasn't this meat salted, actually? So how dare you, how dare the church blame the world for being the world? Was Stott's argument. And I'm not sure what else to think beyond that in some ways, but it's held my heart together for a long time.
Yeah.
John Stott always had a way of sort of striking at the heart of everything, didn't he?
He sure did.
Yeah. That's good stuff. So I love in the Seamless Life, how much you sort of talk about your story and your background and your family history and all of that. Can you talk just a little bit about where your view of vocation sort of comes from?
Sure, I could. Well, because you referenced the book, the very first essay is about my grandfather's saddle blanket. And the book, of course, was a new effort for me and for InterVarsity Press because it was a book with both essays and photos together. So I did my best to take a really interesting photo of the saddle blankets and with the morning light coming in through the windows. And I think it turned out pretty well, actually. Some of the photos weren't as good as I would have wanted, but that one turned out very well. And anybody who asked me, Curry, you included, of course, why do I think about vocation like I do? I probably would begin with my grandfather. And there are two essays in the book about that, actually, about learning about vocation from my grandfather. In the best of Benedictine terms, you know, who called these lovers of God in the 5th century of Italy to follow him, to create a community committed to ora e labora, to praying and to working. My grandfather embodied that for me as a boy over the years of my boyhood. I knew he would lead us as a family literally on our knees at night praying, night after night after night after night, really, in my summertime visits to my grandparents. But then I also realized, you know, that when he went off to work the next day, because he was a cattle buyer in Colorado, that I began to realize that he was really good at what he did, and his peers saw him as really good at what he did. In language I didn't have when I was 10 years old, I began to realize that both character and competence marked his life and the work that he did. People around him sort of took his word as the best word, the truest word, the most important word, the word to make judgments on the basis of. And I realized in some ways that was born out of, you know, the night by night on my knees praying for God and his kingdom to come. I could say more about all that. I think my father, in a different kind of a way, he was a research scientist for the University of California. I remember along the way of my adolescence, him beginning to explain more about his life. And one of the things which intrigued me in a different way than my grandfather, but he talked to me about walking into the laboratory day by day and praying for insight into his work. To understand the connections between ideas, between what he worked on a year ago and 3 years ago with what he was working on this year, to be able to see into the meaning of his work. So on the one hand, when he retired, the secretaries at the research center talked about how nice a man he was and how kind he was and how much he was so interested in their families and how he was a trustworthy man to work with. And they all honored him with affection for, you know, his years of labor like that in an interpersonal way. Which matters to all of us, of course. It does matter. But it also matters that the work itself be seen as important. Not only that I am a Christian in my you know, countenance and then my, you know, my behavior and the words I offer to, you know, the people I work with, which matters a lot, but somehow the work itself matters. There's an intrinsic value and quality to the work. And that for my father, you know, I've come to use the language, my father didn't give this to me, but he would have believed this, that we need to see our own work in the world as common grace for the common good. And for it to be that way, I think that we need to be people of honest insight and to see into what we're doing and why it matters and how it actually is a way to serve the world in and through the work we do. So I can say more about my grandmother, my mother, you know, those are obviously key people in my life, but I would say probably in the book, at least, I've written about both my grandfather and my father.
Yeah. I appreciated you sharing those stories. It's amazing how the those people affect us in profound ways, you know, throughout life and go back to those stories again and again. Pretty awesome. One of the difficult parts in thinking about some of this for me has been over the last couple of years, seeing your work as mattering into the new world, right? The idea that, you know, new heavens and new earth are going to come and, you know, the earth is going to be renewed and God will be present. And see, so the idea is that we see our work as like pushing towards that new creation into the kingdom. How do you talk to people about what that kind of looks like or how to like tangibly think about those sort of things?
We should take a long walk, Curry, and kind of work this out together. I think about it, you think about it, everyone else does too in some ways. When I was a university dropout, you know, a long, long time ago, I dropped out to ask other questions about my life, that other ones that the college and university world wasn't prepared to give room to ask about. But I met a man who was a professor of philosophy in Phoenix, Arizona, and he was an Indian, about India background, come to the States, and you know, very articulate, and very bright, and very willing to talk with me about things that I was thinking about. He persuaded me that expectation affects program, was the way he put it. Expectation affects program. He said it's true of Hindus. His background was Hindu. He said it's true of everybody, actually, that eschatological expectation, what we believe to be true about the future of the world, whether we're Marxists or Maoists or, you know, Muslims or Jews or Christians or evolution materialists or whatever we are, that our eschatological expectation affects program. So if God is gone, there is nothing about the world that is true, you know, in terms of a before and after part of the story, if it's just a bang and a whimper at the end, why wouldn't you eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? Really? Yeah. Why wouldn't you? It makes the most sense, really. But if you believe that somehow there is a new heaven or new earth, you know, sometime we long for in the future. We pray every day with longing, oh, Jesus, oh, Maranatha, come. Please come, Lord Jesus. We pray your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Those are the prayers of our hearts. You know, then we are somehow expecting some continuity. It'd be arrogant for any of us to say, well, it'll be just like this. I know it'll be just like this, really. You know?
Right.
But I expect continuity. So one of my best dreams, Curry, is this one, okay? You learn a lot about me in this one, okay? But I would say, I imagine walking down some beautifully imagined street, you know, beautifully imagined construction of houses. And you just think, wow, that was very nicely done, really. And not because it's grand necessarily, but just beautifully imagined as a place for human beings to dwell. And then you kind of turn a little corner in the street and you see a little opening in front of you and maybe like an opening to what seems maybe a park or a square of some sort. You begin to hear tunes, you know, coming through this opening, you know, ahead of you, and you walk into this beautiful park and there's Bach and Bono riffing together, you know, and you think, I always wanted to be here, actually, you know, Sola Deo Gloria, Johann Sebastian Bach and Bono himself, and they're playing music together, and that's the world I long for, actually, where there's continuity somehow. And of course, it's Tolkien who, not surprisingly, gives us one of the best windows into this with his delightful, profound story called Leif by Niggle. And it's, you know, it's a story we all can understand, even if we're not Catholics and believe in purgatory, that we can understand somehow, you know, the the work we do, the labor we do, the frustrations we have, the disappointments we have, the sorrows and the weight and burden we live with all day long and through the years of our lives. And I'm just summing up the story. I won't ruin it for anybody, but there's a surprising way that Tolkien imagines the continuity between this life and the next. And I think it's probably as good a window as we have into what that might look like as anybody had literature has done. So.
Yeah. I forgot about Leaf by Niggle. I read it in grad school, I remember, and I have not come back to it in a decade or more. So that's great stuff.
Curry, with this questions about work in your podcast, I think it'd be fascinating to dwell on it for a while.
I think you're right about that. I think that's a great point. Actually, I took a class from the director of the Wade Center, where you visited recently, on theological imagination, basically. And we went through all these, you know, literary works. And my background in sort of theology and Bible didn't lend itself to imagination all the time. You know, it was a very, it's always systematic theology, and you're sort of like plumbing the depths of scriptures. But reading with a literary imagination, I think, it's a muscle we don't often exercise, but it's a beautiful thing to be doing, you know.
So who was the director when you took that course?
I cannot remember off the top of my head. I would have to look it up. He passed away a couple of years ago.
Dr. Mitchell.
Yes, that's it. Yes, that's it. Yeah, he was an amazing man.
Wonderful, wonderful man. He and I began to be very close friends in the last years of his life.
Really?
His wife told me in a very tender note, I hope this is okay to say out loud, that when he died unexpectedly, they were on vacation in Colorado, of all places.
Right.
He actually was reading the Visions of Vocation book. It was a very tender word to give to me, and sort of has even more deeply drawn me into their life and his life. But I was a very great sorrow when he died.
Mm. Yeah. So our best friends, the woman of the couple, was mentored by Dr. Mitchell's wife for like her entire life, basically. And they're very, very close family friends. And we're an adoptive family, and he had adopted children. And his words, even in that class 10 years ago, still sort of ring through my head. It's a legacy that he'll never know, that he sort of left that imprint on me. So. That's pretty cool. Yeah, it's good stuff. That's really good stuff. Sorry.
Some things are worth having tears about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, it's good. Okay. So let's talk, what should we talk about now? I feel like I could just plumb the depths with you for, ever on this sort of thing. What does it mean to work for the common good in your mind? And we may have covered this to some extent, but when you even say those words, I don't think those are common things that we as Christians sort of talk about or think about. Can you explain sort of what that is?
Sure, I can try to do that. Again, I mean, it's a question which I work at all the time, Curry. It was explicitly the question of last fall going to Central Europe. Would you come back and talk with us about what would a renewal of vocation mean for the renewal of our society? What does vocation mean for the common good of the former Czechoslovakia 30 years after the Velvet Revolution? Differently done, you know, a few years ago, one of the essays in the book is about being in Birmingham, Alabama a few years ago, and at the 16th Street Baptist Church, which is iconically, tragically remembered as the site of the bombings which killed the little girls in Sunday school and their worship service one morning. And I was asked by some good people in Birmingham if I would come and speak at the first ever prayer breakfast for the city held at the Birmingham 62 Baptist Church. And the question was, what would a renewal of a recovery of the idea of vocation mean for the renewal of our city here in Birmingham? Place we remember maybe most of all today for Bull Connor and for Martin Luther King's letter to the from Birmingham jail. But, you know, 50, 60 years later, people are trying to work things out. But the question was, you know, think about the relation of vocation to the meaning of who we are, how we live together in the city of Birmingham. Mm-hmm. Not unlike, of course, the question from Bratislava and from Prague in Central Europe. So common good, in my mind, maybe in the biblical terms, is best seen through the lens of, you know, the admonition of Jeremiah to the exiles in Babylon, this most iconically terrible city in the history of the world, Babylon. We almost spit it out of our mouths, Babylon. Really. But of course, Jeremiah is saying to the people like Daniel and Meshach and Shadrach and Abednego, seek the flourishing of your city, of Babylon. He doesn't name it, but that's where they're all living, Babylon. Pray for it. If it doesn't flourish, you won't flourish, he says quite plainly. You know, build houses and plant trees and get married and have children and settle in and commit yourself to its welfare. Seek the welfare, seek the flourishing of, seek the common good of, you know, of Babylon. And of course, when you think about someone like Daniel, whose story we know best of all in some ways, you know, he became the chief political counselor to three different rulers. We could use the word tyrants or dictators, because they all were that, you know, over the course of generations. But he was chosen to be the wisest man, the chief counselor to the political leadership of first Iran and then Iraq, as the nations could have changed, you know, identities over the course of Daniel's life. But if you ask, what did he do? What do political counselors do? Well, they weigh in on water resources and building highways and military strength, agricultural, you know, resources. And that's what political counselors are always doing. So he was seen as somebody who was actually, you know, weighing in on the stuff of life for the Babylonian people. It'd be a foolish, you know, I think a flawed way to read Daniel's life to say, oh, Daniel, he was creating space for the Jews to live, you know, because he was a religious advisor after. How could he be not that? You know? But in some ways, you probably haven't lived long enough in the Washington, D.C.'s of the world to realize that political counselors get involved in just the stuff of everyday life for everybody, actually. That's what they're doing. So Daniel was committed himself to that, actually. It's really one of the few books in the Bible, if not one of the only books in the Bible, where you have a whole book about a man's vocation, someone's vocation being worked out over the course of his life. Mm. It's in a strange way, Curry, that, you know, I've read and read and read the book over my years, and, you know, the very last words in the whole book about Daniel are these, and Daniel was perplexed. Mm. And I don't think that is a bad word. You know, somehow, why didn't he end in some kind of moment of great glory, you know? But after all of the things we know best about, of course, the first half of the book is about all the stories we grew up hearing about, you know, lion's dens and fiery furnaces and, you know, dreams. And then, of course, the last half of the book is about Daniel's own mysterious dreams with his own name on these dreams, God himself speaking to Daniel, saying, Daniel, it'll be like this. And every dream he gets, it's another story of, literally, the text puts it this way, and Daniel couldn't sleep that night. Mm. Daniel's face became flushed. You know? And finally, the very last words in the whole book are, and Daniel was perplexed. Mm. I take that as, in a strange way, a strange comfort to me.
Yeah.
Because I realize that I, too, live in a now but not yet world, and I see things, but through a glass darkly, and I understand, but I don't understand. I know, but I don't know. So for me, when I, you know, think about what it means to, you know, work out our vocation for the sake of the common good, we do our best, we do our darndest in some ways. I have latched onto the imagery of a signpost, actually, because in some ways it seems to me like it makes sense of the best we do, a signpost, because we never get it all done, never get it all right, you know, and our best efforts, you know. Let's work for tax reform, you know, because that needs to happen, you know, and then you do that and you do your best and you are politically able and strategic enough to get the right votes at the right time in the right place and something important happens. But you realize when all is said and done, not everything happened. It didn't all happen, really.
Right.
But it's a signpost, perhaps, of some justice being done, some mercy being shown in the history of the world, you know, for a moment in time, really. It's kind of like your marriage and my marriage, I suppose. At least I'll speak about my marriage. I mean, my wife loves me, which is a great gift of my life. You know, and we've been married for a while together, and I take my delight in her. I love to love my wife. But at best, our marriage is a signpost of, you know, of what could be and someday will be. I work for the Mars Corporation a little bit of my life, and Mars makes a lot of stuff, M&M's included. I'm a a fellow for the think tank of the Mars Corporation. Hmm. I would never, ever say that anybody should eat all day long M&Ms. You know, it's not true, of course. You know. But it's also true that almost anybody in the world at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon would love a few M&Ms. You know, thinking, really? Sure, I'll take M&Ms, please, thank you. You know, I don't want a whole bag, but yeah, I'd love to have 4 or 5, thank you. That'd be wonderful, really. It's a little bit of a delight in the world. Hmm. Look, bringing a smile to our faces, really. Now, is it everything? No. But it's a little remembering. Maybe it's a signpost, actually, of some good gift in the world that in the midst of all the things that don't go very right all day long, you know, I did get some M&Ms at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thank you. You know, and I can press out that more fully. The project I'm a part of with Mars is not born of Christian commitments, but it's called the Economics of Mutuality. Mm. Tried to rethink the way business is done all over the face of the earth, actually. I have a different way to understand what bottom lines actually do mean in reality, where a more complex bottom line is required if you want to keep making money over time.
Right.
And so it's calling into question, actually, given that you're Chicago based there, the Chicago School of Economics, the Milton Friedman model, and saying that just doesn't ask enough questions, frankly. If all we require of businesses to maximize shareholder profit, it isn't a big enough question to ask, actually. If you want to keep making money, at least, you have to ask other questions. I took the Mars executives to meet Wendell Berry some years ago down in Kentucky in his farm. And the very end of the day, he said to us memorable words that are etched into my heart now. He said, you know, if you want to make money for a year, you have to ask certain questions. If you want to make money for 100 years, you have to ask other questions. I would say most times when we get to questions about the common good, it's more those 100-year questions. Because in some ways, it's the longer good. It's the more satisfying, important questions that have to be asked. You know, when we're married for a year, you have to ask certain questions. We married for 10 years and 40 years, you have to ask other questions, actually. So common good, in my mind, always has to do with a longer sense of flourishing, not just that I've sort of flamed and got all that I wanted, you know, and then I'm done.
Right.
You know, years into it, you know, is there still a deepening delight, a deepening sense of, you know, this is me, what I'm made to do with my life. This is actually a good gift to the world. It's really a way to love my neighbor as I love myself, and not only personally, but institutionally and corporately. So common good is about that.
Yeah, that is yes. That's a great answer. I'm still processing it in a lot of ways. Even like taking the Mars Corporation down to hang out with Wendell Berry. I mean, that's like that is really cool. Okay, if we could, I'd love to go back to what we were talking about, the new creation and what sort of life looks like. And I think about my role as a pastor in the new creation, right? And as a pastor, I sort of, my job is to point people to Jesus, right? And in the new creation, you know, Jesus like literally exists with us. And so is my job still going to be sort of like, hey, there's Jesus over there. And everybody's like, yeah, I know, because Jesus is like with us, you know, like what does a role of a pastor look like in the new creation? I guess I think about some. I think about that because I wonder as pastors, if we are doing enough to show people how they should be equipping people for going about doing good work in the world. Or are we just sort of building our worlds, our church world, as it were? How do you suggest that churches go about sort of better equipping their people to be working for the common good?
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful question, Curry. Well, I would go back to my time out of school when I was 20 for a couple of years and hitchhiking around and living in communes and asking questions about things and hearing these words, expectation affects program. But I would say that, you know, in a pastor's role, a lot of it is, in my mind, is to help people learn to live in the world faithfully and creatively and steadfastly. And how do you be the salt of the earth, the light of the world? That seems to me to be pretty central, you know, to what the work of the pastor is. I had a business leader call me some years ago and say, I didn't know him. He said, can I talk to you about work? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I already have some questions for you. And it turned out to be, as he put it this way, I spent my life on Wall Street. I've led corporations and we've worked all over the world. And I've been part of churches too in my life. And I've never, ever heard a sermon where I thought that the pastor thought about somebody like me. It wasn't that I was looking for some cheap exegesis of Habakkuk and saying, well, on Wednesday, when you go to Germany for this multinational deal you're making, you know, do it this way because Habakkuk speaks to you. You know, I don't want to be cheap, really. I just want the sense that maybe the pastor wrestled with the text in light of somebody like me. He said to me this way, these are haunting words to me, Curry. He said, he sees me in church. I think he thinks I live here too. I don't, actually. Maybe a very, you know, concrete window into all this, but one of my best friends is a man who is very entrepreneurial by nature, just thinks entrepreneurially all the time. He's had some very good ideas that have served the world and made good money, and one of them was to create the first fleet of taxis in America that were, you know, with environmentally responsible cars. Bought a whole fleet of Priuses, actually, and served Washington, D.C. with the Priuses. Called an EnviroCab, you know, and then Seattle picked up the idea, and then LA did, and Minneapolis did, and Denver did. And he was the first person to imagine this, actually. Wow. We also started a company called Elevation Burger, and Elevation Burger's tagline was, burgers the way they're meant to be. So his burgers the way they're meant to be were burgers that were made out of, you know, good beef, actually, healthy beef. They were actually from cows that had been fed good food. You know, he fried his French fries in olive oil rather than other kinds of oil because it just works better in your stomach after all is said and done.
Right.
You know, I came to the conclusion some years ago, Curry, that I could never eat McDonald's or Five Guys anymore in my life because I would just get sick in my stomach. It just never ever settle in my stomach. And you couldn't have enough Tums to deal with it. Just was going to continue to roil through until it got all done. You know, but I realized when I ate with my friend Hans Hesse's hamburgers, you know, and with him and his fries, that my stomach didn't even blink, really, didn't even, you know, raise a question. It just was like, yeah, good for you, Steve, you know, good for you today. You know, this food just goes right on where it's supposed to go, really. And in some ways, my theology is pretty intuitively formed after all is said and done, and realizing that, you know, somehow when you actually care about the food you eat, that it's healthy and tasty together.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, Men's Health magazine did a competition of all the hamburger places in America. And my friend Hans's Burgers won the whole shebang.
Actually. Are you serious?
The whole country. He won the top prize. That's the tastiest, healthiest hamburger in America. Now, he never named his hamburgers, you know, holy hamburgers. But I would tease him off and I said, Hans, you know, you've got this kind of burger. How about for the Christians who come into the store, a holy hamburger? Because, of course, they'd like to have it be called a Christian hamburger, wouldn't they? Because we want Christian this, Christian that. And, you know, and he would smile back at me. And but what I did say to him, Curry, was this about, you know, the continuity of this life and the next. And maybe it's a good word for a pastor to some way have eschatological visions and imaginations to help people understand the meaning of their work. I said, Hans, you know, you're making eschatological hamburgers, you know.
Right.
And he would smile at me and he'd say, so I'm sure of this, Hans. I don't know about some things, but I'm sure of this, that when we eat finally, that great, great, great day, the marriage supper of the Lamb. Of course, the interesting thing to note is our first thing together will be a supper.
Yeah.
A great celebratory supper, actually. I said, everything on the table will be tasty and healthy together. There'll be no trade-offs. There won't be an end full of apples and an end full of donuts. You know, it won't be like that. It was somehow by God's own cosmic, you know, divine imagination, all healthy, all tasty together, all throughout the table, actually. So for you to do your best now, Hans, in this life, to create hamburgers that are healthy and tasty together, you see, it's a signpost of the kingdom, actually. So good for you and good for the rest of us.
If there is more blessed work out there than creating a hamburger like that, I don't know what it is, because that is a real gift to the world, I think. You know, I love it. That's good. Steve, I could literally just sit here and talk to you all day, but I feel like we probably should, you know, call it at some point. So are you ready to jump into the final two questions?
Sure. Yep.
So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
When I was first married, my wife and I decided we would focus on being married for a while, rather than anything else. Trying to figure out how, in the 20th century, do you take these words in the, you know, long ago to the young men of Israel, don't go off to war the first year, you know, love your wife. We decided rather than to start into graduate school immediately or to do this immediately, we would just find a way to live together simply and spend most of our time together. Just finding patterns and rhythms and habits of heart that would allow us to take pleasure in each other's company. So there's nothing I still, you know, 40 years later, love more than simply just to be with my wife. Yeah. I've traveled a lot in my life and I love to travel with my wife, but sometimes I go other places and people, for years and years, I traveled most every week someplace, which I don't want to keep doing in my life. But it was, how do you do this, Steve? I would say, well, I've been given a holy adrenaline, I think, to do this right now for this season. When I'm done each week, I have to come and hug my wife for a while. Hmm. In some ways, I would say that was born of that decision early on. What did I do in that year then, you asked, the strange job I had? I drove a little school bus, a big van actually, for really smart kids in the city we lived in, who were picked out as seven-year-olds as like being the smartest kids in the city. And one day a week, they would go off to a particular school for a specialized, you know, high-level second-grade education for really smart kids, really. And I'd pick up a different group each day, morning, and then take it back in the afternoon. And that made enough on my side of the equation for us to put together our little small paltry salaries to live simply and with pleasure and happiness together for the first year of life in our marriage. So.
Wow. That's a great story, even behind the job. Good work there. That's awesome. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Well, a lot of things could be said, Corey, but maybe I would, you know, come back to the prayer of Jesus. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It seems to me that if we don't get that one right, don't understand that in a way that I think we should understand that, we're really going to miss the meaning of our lives and our labors. I think there is to be some kind of embeddedness that God intends us to be about in this world, to step in and to commit ourselves with love. I've been taken by the question for many years now, how do we learn to see ourselves as responsible for love's sake, for the way the world is and isn't? And so it seems to me that biblically speaking, from the very words of Jesus himself, that when we pray with hope and with meaning, with desire, with longing, you know, that my life this day, O Lord, that the lives of your people this day all over the face of the earth, we would be this, we would commit ourselves again this day to your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And I think in some ways, of course, I mean, you'd have probably have to push that out and tease that out and think about it maybe more carefully and more deeply. But I think, you know, it provides parameters for understanding that, you know, what we give ourselves to day by day, what we're about day by day, actually has meaning in the eschatological unfolding of redemptive history, you know, throughout time. And so I guess I probably would begin there and then push that out a little bit with somebody.
Yeah, it's good stuff. That's good stuff. I can't say thanks enough for making time for me again. And it was a real pleasure to chat with you.
You too, Corey. It's been a great gift to me. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Steve. I was very encouraged by this episode. You heard me get a little emotional there. And I think just it's amazing how God brings things together. And so I hope you felt that encouragement in this episode. I hope you're encouraged in your job even today. I just ask that you share away and maybe encourage somebody else in their job in the way they think about how they do their work. And I would greatly appreciate that. You can also scroll to the bottom of your iTunes app right now and leave a rating and review there. It just helps get the word out about the podcast. And yeah, I know hustle's a little strange right now, but until next time, get out there or stay in and hustle.